Hey, watchers. My name's Kevin Strange.
My name's Jeremy Daniels.
And we're from the Reading to Strangers podcast, where you can hear serialized stories and books from the Kevin Strange fiction catalog each and every week, right, Jeremy?
Oh, I thought it was the podcast to watch Kevin Strange burn his career down, but I guess I'm wrong.
I mean, that's basically what it is. So come subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and where all other podcasts are found there, gang. Reading to Strangers.
Shit.
Fuck.
Shit, fuck.
To Watching with Strangers, gang. My name is Kevin Strange.
This is Travis.
The Encyclopedia Britannica. And amateur arm wrestling aficionado. Have we added anything else to your credentials here?
No, Travis, no, you're still Travis has always, you're still a UFC aficionado.
Travis has always been, he's kind of been self-conscious that he only has a single name. And I have two. Oh, I didn't unplug the, you talk.
Well, while Kevin unplugs the damn refrigerator again, the refrigerator from hell.
Highly professional.
Yes, highly professional. All for you guys.
At least it happened 30 seconds in and not in the middle of a big long
tirade. Now that we've cleared that.
So Travis has always been a little self-conscious about only having one name when I have two, and so I always give him these big long introductions.
Well, you know, it's worked so well for others. Madonna.
Aikido. Aikido.
Well, see, I've never studied Aikido, but I've always been fascinated about it. I've read about it.
Right. Which would make you a
armchair aficionado.
Yeah. An Aikido aficionado. No, amateur arm wrestling aficionado.
I give you props, Kevin. You know your shit when it comes to UFC and martial arts.
I try.
Yeah.
I try. For being a big fat guy that doesn't do any martial arts, I know a little bit.
You're an armchair warrior.
Speaking of martial arts. We got another 80s action movie here in the top 10.
Well,
we
hold on out there a second. Last episode, we were talking 89. Mm-hmm. But turns out, the official release date for this was in 1990.
Oh,
so we're still barely by the skin of our teeth in the 90s.
In the 1990s. Excuse me. Like I said last week, it's hard to tell, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sure the production dates on this were like 88, 89,
right.
And then it was released in 90. But
it had two separate releases. It started with a limited and then went wide.
Had it even been, you know, released in 89, it's still, or 90 or 91, it's all of it had that same exact, that movie feels just as much 90 or 91 as it would 88 or 89. Like that time period, very little changed culturally during that period. So it was really when Bush took us into Desert Storm, that really felt like the 90s, right? That's when it really felt like we were headed towards a new era.
And really, there's only one thing in this movie that dates it. And we'll talk about this more, but the soundtrack is not the strong point of the film in this case.
Well, this is another case of... This is a Travis movie. This is another Travis movie. Top 10. I kind of like that we're sort of swapping back and forth. Although I think, I think Out for Justice was your pick as well. But it's one of my favorite movies of all time. So
the mutual pick.
Yeah, it was a lot of these are mutual picks. But
have you seen this one before?
I have. Okay. I have when I was a kid though, and
so it's been a while.
Watching it back now, I was just asking myself the same thing I asked about A Boy and His Dog, like. Top 10?
It's
top 10.
It's one of the most kid-friendly R-rated movies you'll ever see.
Well, it's bizarre. It's bizarre in how violent it is at times and
but
how...
not graphic.
How... very graphic.
Well...
very graphic. We'll get into it.
Yeah, a little bit.
We'll
parts.
Get into it. Oh, it's, you know, if you, yeah, if you don't
well,
consider
I won't say
that,
not graphic, I'll say not bloody.
If you don't consider dismemberment...
No, graphic. It's not very bloody at all, though.
No, no. Not much blood, but...
We'll differentiate between graphic and bloody.
But very... lots of violence and yet at times very goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very goofy.
Well, Do you want to talk a little bit about the story first, or
what do you want? This is your movie. This is your week.
There's a reason for that. Do you know what the source material really is?
Well, I want to know why you picked this movie.
Part of the reason I picked it is because this, or do we, maybe we should tell them what we're talking about first.
Have we even announced
the title? We haven't. Once again, we dropped the ball. This week we're talking about the 1990 martial arts comedy action film, Blind Fury, starring Rutger Hauer.
It's the comedy part, I think, that I threw me for a loop, because I don't remember it being funny when I was a kid.
Well,
I remember
as a kid, you're looking for the action.
Yeah, I remember it being really action-heavy and violence-heavy, and I remember Rutger Hauer being a bad motherfucker as a blind guy. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the goofy shit.
Well, that's one of the reasons I picked it. Another reason I picked it is, well, the primary reason I picked it is I wanted to represent Rutger Hauer. Because if you're going to talk to 80s and 90s, 80s and early 90s, and you want to represent a film, a cult film, I felt like we had to have something, we had to have a Rutger Hauer vehicle in the top 10. At least for me, he was one of those names that we didn't really talk about when we were talking about Stallone or Over the Top, because it doesn't really fit.
Rutger Hauer, though, I think he was more of a...
He crossed genres.
But if those were all A-level action stars, you have a subset, a B-level, and that's what one of the things I was going to mention was, this movie, it reminds me of a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. One of the things it really reminds me of is there was an action comedy genre that was more of a B-level genre in the that sort of sprang up out of the 80s, but was more dominant.
Any of Jackie Chan's American releases.
It was more dominant in the 90s, and that stuff was hitting in the 90s. But this movie most closely reminds me of Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
In that that is an
not
action,
as goofy, it's but an it has elements comedy. Of that, yeah.
It's very much centered in a... Absolutely. But even though this guy's an American, it's still a fish out of water type story, and everybody looks at him like he's different because he's blind.
Right.
And with Crocodile Dundee, everybody looked at him differently because he was dressed, you know, quote unquote Australian, although that's just I don't think anybody in Australia actually dresses like that. But you know what I mean, with his accent and everything.
Right.
People were always picking fights with him because he was different. And then hilarity and violence would ensue.
Right.
And that's very much the formula that this film is based in. Mm-hmm. So it very much, those two reminded me of each other a lot. But there's a whole lot of these B-level action movies that don't necessarily have to have the comedy element to it. And this is definitely one of the, I would say, one of the better ones. This is one.
It's also an example of something you don't... I mean, it's prevalent from the 70s through the 80s into the 90s, but it's sparse in that it's a crossover genre film. Meaning you have East meets West, which happens from action to nowadays more in horror than anything. But during those times, you had in action and a little bit of Western, but they're rare. They're sparse. This is one of the rare examples where often you have, I mean, one of the most famous is American Ninja.
American Ninja even...
Where you have East meets West, where you have swordplay versus typical American action movie.
Or this was television, but also one of the B-level action stars was David Carradine's Kung Fu.
Kung Fu,
and Kung Fu, The Legend Continues.
Yeah. And to some extent, you got Shogun, which is more dramatic. Yeah. But there's that subgenre element, too.
That's what people today call cultural appropriation and consider racist. And that's actually not just me throwing a political jab out there. No, have you seen the... because this is very relevant to the kind of film that we're reviewing. Have you seen the reviews for this Iron Fist show? The new Marvel
show?
No, but
I've heard their term... I've been hearing their term apart. Is it because he's a white guy?
It's because he's a fucking... Okay, so...
That's you the have, source material.
You have one of the weakest entries, I think, in the Marvel cinematic universe on Netflix in Luke Cage. But it's all good because it's a black dude. Mm. And nobody is criticizing that show at all, even though episodes 6, 7, 8, and 9 will put you to sleep. If you have insomnia, you can go right to bed watching 6, 7, 8, and 9 of that show, because it is so goofy, boring, and like, what is this even, what is happening now? And Iron Fist may be a bad story that may be poorly told, but I believe Jessica Jones and Luke Cage were poorly told stories, and no one is willing to give them any criticism at all. Marvel can do no wrong. Marvel wipes Marvel wipes its ass with money when it comes to doing anything concerning feminism, doing anything concerning minorities. But you take a white guy that plays a mystic. Mm-hmm. And a kung fu mystic, and suddenly it's cultural appropriation.
Even though, just like with Jessica Jones and Luke Cage, they're still following the source material, but in this case, it's not okay because the source material focuses on a white guy.
It's crazy nuts. It really is ridiculous. And so that's what happens today. Back in the 80s and 90s, and like you said, the 70s, this was considered cultural enrichment. This was considered the ability for a Western audience to learn about Eastern mysticism, Eastern philosophy, and Eastern religions in a way that was consumable to them. You know, Shogun is a perfect example of a show that dropped a white dude in feudal Japan and allowed for him to be completely integrated into that culture, and by proxy, the audience to be completely integrated into that culture. Now, Blind Fury, it ain't Blind Fury ain't Shogun. In fact, I was kind of surprised, again, watching back on it. I thought, because if you watch the Rambo movies, there's a lot of flashbacks in the Rambo movies to him being, was it in Cambodia or was it Vietnam or wherever he was in the Rambo movies, you keep having flashbacks throughout the movies to sort of understand where Rambo is mentally. Right.
You have that here a couple spots.
With Rutger Hauer in this film, you get the very beginning of the film, you see his cultural integration into, I'm assuming, the Vietnamese.
Yeah, he's a Vietnam War vet, and basically he loses.
So it's a small Vietnamese village that takes him in. We can get into the story in a little bit, but I'm only saying that it was it's sort of you get that cultural assimilation in the very beginning of the movie, but he doesn't really have any flashbacks. He has flashbacks to the war.
Well, there's two flashbacks later on,
to the war.
Right.
But not to the villain. You know, once you get through his little
basically in the opening montage scene, in the beginning, you get the montage that sets up why about his character, how he is.
And it never really goes back to that. But at the same time, it's almost like the only thing they taught him was how to be a badass. Because you don't really get this
through
character.
His dialogue and how he carries himself throughout the film, you kind of, you know, it's not spoon fed to you, which I'm okay with. But if you read between the lines, you get the sense that the way he lives his life now is very much a part of what he learned from the natives.
Well, he
took him in and healed him and taught him how to survive. Not only swordplay, but, you know, you don't see it firsthand, but it's like they obviously taught him how to survive as a blind person, and then also how to live a different type of life.
And he even says, there's a line of dialogue later in the film during the climax where he says, it's almost like there were two Nicks.
Right.
The one before and the one after.
One now, right.
But I'm saying the writing could have been better to express that, because they really only kind of show you that.
Keep in mind
that
it's only an
86
minute movie, too.
Yeah, it's very, very quick. It goes very fast.
And it's very good pace.
Let's talk about some of the people in this.
Absolutely.
In this thing. So this film.
Well, in short, to answer your question, though.
I asked the question?
Why I picked this one. Other than it being a Rutger Hauer vehicle, it's a film that covers a lot of different things that you don't see prevalent in a lot of movies.
All right. So, let's talk about the filmmakers.
Okay. So, the film was directed by a man named Philip Noyce.
Mm-hmm.
Name, maybe not a household name, but... When you start hearing some of his filmography, you'll understand you've seen a lot of this guy's work.
Very much so.
So, going back to 89, that movie called Dead Calm, nice little suspense thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you're familiar with the name Jack Ryan, go back to Patriot Games in 92 and Clear and Present Danger in 94. He directed both of those.
Yeah, and the Jack Ryan films continued on with who's the it was Ben Affleck, right? Carried on the Jack Ryan.
I think it was like when it was a younger version.
Yeah,
I didn't see those. I don't remember who that was.
Yeah, that Ben Affleck played him.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because in these two, Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger, he's already integrated into
Harrison Ford.
Yeah, and he's already right, fully integrated into the government, right? Right. In the Earth, they go back and do prequels with Ben Affleck.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I haven't seen him though.
So yeah, where he, you know, it's like when he's still just a CIA grunt, and it's okay. Like as he like.
I didn't realize it was Ben Affleck, huh?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. I might be. People are gonna be like, "Oh, that's not right."
Sorry, we may have to start that errors and omissions part.
yeah.
But as you're looking that up, I did a little Sharon Stone vehicle that wasn't as well received as.
Some of All Fears. Some of All Fears with Ben Affleck.
Okay.
The Hunt for Red October with Sean Connery is also apparently a Jack Ryan film. And then they tried to bring him back in 2014 with.
It was like a prequel.
With what's his name? With. Go ahead.
But in 92, alongside Patriot Games, he did Sliver.
Which Chris was Pine.
Chris Pine, okay. Yeah. With Captain Kirk. new Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
But did Sliver in 92, which was the less successful Sharon Stone vehicle.
Yeah. I didn't mind that. I thought that was a pretty cool little flip.
It was okay.
If I watched it today, it probably wouldn't hold up. But I remember back at the time. Because isn't Sliver, isn't that where she's being spied on by her tenant of the apartment complex she lives in?
There's no beavers in that movie.
It's not a bad film, though. I thought that was a pretty scary film.
It's okay.
That was like the era. The 90s was like, that was like for those...
A lot of those
titillating, fucking, you fucked my husband 20 years ago and now I'm getting revenge.
The Richie Batteries
era. I changed my sex, now I'm a woman, but I was really the man from that you got fired.
Crying game. But then I Let Myself Go, Val Kilmer, 97, he directed The Saint, which is still, I love that movie.
So it's a lot of fun. So this guy is very much a mainstream Hollywood.
Yeah. Hasn't done a lot in the recent years.
Well, he did The Giver. That was a huge film.
He did Salt, which I didn't see, but from what I understand was kind of a flop.
Yeah, they were huge films, though.
Yeah.
Huge.
He's got a couple of things in production or pre-production, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, Philip Noyce directed the film, which was written by a guy named Charles Robert Carner. Now, this is a... We were talking about Philip Noyce directing some pretty well-known movies. Charles Robert Carner, a movie I would love to show up in our podcast someday, but may not. Gymkhata?
Gymkhata is one of the craziest action movies you will ever come across.
Just give him a two-cent
if you're talking
explanation of what
Gymkhata A-level is. Action movies from the 80s and 90s,
like
B-level.
G or H.
This is like Z. Gymkhata is like Z-level. And it actually surprised the shit out of me. That the guy that wrote Gymkhata was ever even able to come back and write anything even remotely successful.
He only wrote one other relatively known theatrical film, and that was Let's Get Harry. Pretty much everything else he wrote was TV movies.
So Gymkhata is about this gymnast kid that Gymkhata is a martial art that I'm assuming doesn't actually exist in the world.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
It's a gymnastics martial art. So think about this. Written to the script conveniently are scenes where he is always in front of two seahorse, what is it? What are they called? Some things that he's able
very
to
gymnastics
that he's
related.
Able to grapple onto and do gymnastics from.
So in other words, out in the open field, kick people, he's completely worthless.
So he can kick people in the face with Gymkhata martial arts. And I remember. I haven't seen that movie in so long, but I remember that he like ends up in a village of like mutants. Do you remember this?
It's been a while. I've been meaning to watch it again.
He ends up having to kick the asses of a whole village full of mutants.
It's beyond bizarre.
It is. So it delighted me to see Gymkhata on the list here, because that way we get to talk about it a little bit. And it might. I mean, I would love to do it, but it's not a good movie.
No.
I'm not sure there's many good things we could find to say about it, but
no.
I mean, I could make fun of Gymkhata for an hour and a half.
Maybe that's another podcast. Yeah. But the point I want to get to with the writing, and I don't know, I'm assuming you're aware of this, but the original source material for this film actually goes back a couple decades, in that this is essentially a remake of a whole series of serial films and serial TV productions based on a character named Zatoichi. And Zatoichi, also known as the Blind Swordsman, was a Japanese favorite. He was and today Criterion has numerous releases of the different films, where it has very much the same tone as this movie. It's an action movie, but it's very much a goofy comedy too. Because you've got this highly skilled blind swordsman that goes around walking around just portraying himself as a helpless blind man and only reveals his skills when necessary.
Wouldn't say that that's what happens in this movie, but that's what it's definitely trying to get across. Yeah. It comes off to me as way more awkward and weird than it does. Like, I mean, I get it. Yeah. As I'm watching the film, I understand that he's trying to be Mr. Humble, but he comes off like Bozo the Clown than anything in those moments where he's supposedly, because there's a moment in the movie where a guy gives him super hot sauce instead of giving him
that's the early bar scene that I was going to talk about. That scene in particular, and we'll get to that, it's very early in the movie, so I don't mind jumping to it right now, but in that scene, it someone not familiar with the Zatoichi material will look at it very understandably and go, oh, he's trying to be Jackie Chan from like Rumble in the Bronx. If you remember that movie, his uncle does not allow him to fight. So anytime he gets into a fight, he has to play it off like everything's accidental. Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. Oops, how'd that happen?
Right.
And so Howard kind of does this whole, I don't know if it's a nod, you know, probably more to Zatoichi, the source material, but it can play over to Jackie Chan's films to where it's like, you know, it's very goofy in that everything's, oops, sorry, accident, and he's like kicking these guys' ass. You know, it's like five or six on one.
But that's not the only time he does it. There's also a moment in the film where the little kid, who unfortunately didn't have very many roles after Blind Fury.
Yeah, the biggest role was before.
You could take him and you could take that kid from Over the Top and, man, make a movie with those two cats.
Child actors that did not make it.
Make a movie with those two cats. See what
that's
you
a
did.
Reality TV series. Yeah. I think we have $1 million idea right there.
Yeah,
have like a Big Brother real world reality TV concept where you take child stars that are now adults, put them in a house together and see what happens.
Well, you put them in a house together and convince them that they're all making a movie.
There you go.
And you film them all.
Or there's only one role available and they're all
well, that's what and it's all like they don't know they're being filmed.
Well, of course not, yeah.
And you gotta just watch how fucking goofy these child actors that are like, this is my shot, brother. You can't take this from me. This is my shot, not yours. And
it's all
these
watched up.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like an awesome reality show.
I'd watch it.
And it's too bad reality TV
and
died.
I hate reality TV.
It's too bad reality TV died 10 years ago, unless you're a Kardashian. What was I at? Oh, so the little kid, tries to give him a rock to eat it, and he pretends like he bites it, and he pretends like he swallows it, and then he just spits it in the kid's face. But
he's
so goofy while he's doing it. And there's other moments in the movie too.
Well, I still couldn't get over how much of an asshole this kid was in the beginning of the film.
Oh my god! And again, it's like I get it. Like that's the B story of the film is that this kid develops this. You know, he hates him at first.
The sort of Eastern Zen mentality.
But that's the same story that was told in Over the Top.
Right, he starts off kind of an asshole, too.
Over the Top ends up being a way better played movie.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the limitations of
Rutger Hauer was fine, but the supporting cast is
very
90s B action movie.
Rutger Hauer is doing what he's told to do. I'm not going to put the blame on his shoulders, but that goofy stuff is so like head scratching. It's like, and like you said, it's a nod to source material. It's a nod to Jackie Chan, and Jackie Chan was goofy in all of his.
Right.
Maybe I'm just not the biggest action comedy fan.
Yeah,
if I'm gonna watch action, I want it to be because you know, like Over the Top is goofy as all fuck, but it plays itself straight.
Right,
and I love that kind of my favorite type of ridiculous is the type of ridiculous that plays itself straight.
Right.
The kind of pratfall.
Not wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah, the pratfall, wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of comedy has never been something that I've been into.
I can understand that.
Even the Three Stooges is like something that I get it, and it'll make me laugh, but it is not something that I gravitate towards. I'm much more into stuff that is unintentionally weird or unintentionally bad. So, and there are moments in this, I mean, this is a cool movie, but those types of moments really took me out of it and made me just go,
But to give the proper credit to the source material, that writer's name was Ryozo Kasahara, is the Japanese screenwriter who originally came up with the Zatoichi concept and stories that this is based off of. Let's talk about the cast.
The kid, like we said, he didn't really have much after this, which was kind of sad, but he wasn't very good, so...
Let's talk briefly about the kid's mom. And what I want to say about Meg that
Ryan.
Is...
Meg Ryan.
What are you talking about?
Meg Ryan.
We're not that far into the 90s, dude. Meg Foster.
Oh, I'm sorry. Meg Foster.
Oh, man. She's got perhaps the most beautiful eyes in color cinema history.
Meg Foster, who's most well-known for... What do you think her most
They
well
Live.
Known? Well, I was going to say they Live.
Evil Inn and Masters of the Universe.
Evil Inn and Masters of the Universe, but also she's the second-in-command evil lizard monster in the V series.
Oh, our TV series. Our TV series, yeah.
And there's a moment where she, like, it's like a reveal. It's one of the reveals.
She's one of your favorites, too.
What's that?
Oblivion.
Oh, yeah.
And then Lords of Salem as well.
She's good in Lords of Salem. I think she's even in the newest Rob Zombie movie for a few minutes.
31? Maybe.
I think she's in 31 a little bit. But you cut me off.
Sorry.
I don't remember what I was...
You're talking about V.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember if they've ripped, because, like, in V, you don't know what the fuck these things are. Mm. They're humanoid-looking. They look exactly like humans.
Yeah.
And they come to Earth, and they're trying to integrate into the population. They're trying to get, and they're, like, putting posters, like, propaganda everywhere. The visitors are your friends. The visitors are your friends. And I forget if she is the first reveal, or if somebody grabs a hold of their skin, the skin of the leader, and rips it off and reveals that he's actually a lizard person under it. But I think the first reveal is her when she takes a rat out of a cage and her entire jaw descends and she swallows the thing whole. And that, as a little kid,
I forgot all about her being in that.
Freaked me out. Yeah, she has beautiful eyes. Meg Foster. I apologize for the Meg Ryan. I mean, with, there's
nothing against Meg Ryan in her day, but
Meg Ryan is in a new film, and I didn't even recognize her. It's her what's her name? Amy Schumer.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Amy Schumer and Meg Ryan, and Meg Ryan, and until they put the title up that, you know, with her name, I didn't recognize that it was
That's an interesting thing.
She does not look like the same human being. Huh. Having said that, Meg Foster doesn't look too great these days either. She looks like
her eyes are so beautiful.
Her eyes are beautiful,
she looks a little rough.
She looks like she was left out in the sun. All due respect.
My guess is she's a smoker.
She looks like a
raisin. She kind of looks like women who, once you get past middle age, deteriorate fast because they smoke.
She looks like a raisin.
But her eyes are still gorgeous.
They are.
But sadly enough, beautiful eyes is very briefly in this movie.
Well, but she's also only very briefly in They Live. That's one of the things I was going to mention, was her part in They Live, which we'll probably do on this show, is so fucking badass, because Roddy Piper thinks that she's like on his side, and he, like, there's a moment, like, they're up in her apartment, and they're talking, and she fucking shoves him and throws him, and he busts out her window.
Spoiler alert.
And falls two stories down and rolls down this hill. And it's just this. And I think that's the last moment you see her in the film. If she's in it, she's only in it for another scene.
Yeah.
So she makes these weird brief cameos in these films. And here, yeah, she gets one scene. She only gets one scene, but it's well, I mean, she's a great actress.
Yeah.
She gets the shit
She's
shot
very prevalent
out of her.
In the. The 80s or 90s.
It actually it shocked me watching this, because, again, you know, you said it's not bloody, but she gets fucking her side blown out by
Slag, played by the next guy I want to talk about, another 80s staple, Randall Tex Cobb. Tex in apostrophes, his nickname. Do you want to talk a little about him, or you want me to talk about him? Okay, so I don't know if you know this or not, you might find it interesting, but Randall Cobb was an actor who's very much typecast character actor from the 80s, early 90s, where he always played the heavies, a big, tough guy looking dude. Usually had kind of a mullet thing going. But he's actually, prior to getting into acting, he was a professional heavyweight boxer and kickboxer on a contender level.
Okay.
And then made his transition into action movies because, as we've discussed, this was an era fraught with action movies being produced.
And that's kind of a problem that guys today, like in like UFC fighters, mixed martial artists, they have, and they're in films. Like, I could name a dozen films that have appearances by mixed martial arts guys, but the era, the man action movie era is so far past that these guys, it's very difficult. In fact, Ronda Rousey has been trying to transition into film, and it's been said that she's just not a good enough actress. Mm. Now, if she was 20 years younger, your acting ability didn't have anything to do with it.
Versus, what's her name that did that transition before her?
Oh, Gina Carano.
Yeah,
Gina Carano was terrible as an actress. Well, she gets what they call protected.
Yeah.
Where the roles she gets and the stuff that she does in films She doesn't have to do a lot other than physicality. Right. She gets to do everything, but she never... It's not like she's delivering Gettysburg Address.
What's the name of the movie that Soderbergh directed? I mean, when you got a director like that, you're pretty well padded.
Yeah. So, but yeah, for back in this era, it was... You had a lot of... You know, even we just talked about They Live, Roddy Piper. Yeah. Who only really did two films, but the two films he did are considered cult classics. If they're not the greatest films of all time, he's still considered, he's still celebrated for them. Yeah. And that was an era.
He did more than that, but these are the only two that most people remember.
Hulk Hogan was a big action comedy star.
None of the movies he did were any good.
No, not really.
But he did a number of them also.
But yeah, wrestlers and fighters and all those people, excuse me, all those... physical types had work in the 80s and 90s and in front of the camera, because I mean a lot of those people could still get roles today as stunt people, right. But you had a lot of those guys, even like Kane Hodder, who started as a stunt guy, ended up transitioning to the front of the camera. We talked about him on the was it Out for Justice that he's in
just briefly.
You know what's weird is I was scrolling through my Instagram the other night, and I think it was Bloody Disgusting. I follow them on Instagram. They had the still of Kane Hodder from Out for Justice. And I was like, why would that... The same week we do the show on Out for Justice, they share the picture of Kane Hodder from that movie. And you're right, it is brief. Yeah. I didn't recognize it. And he's a very recognizable guy.
Well, honestly, I didn't realize it either until I happened to see it in my research. It's like, oh, really? I went back home. Yeah, that's him. But yeah, Randall Tex Cobb, man, he's been in everything from The Golden Child, Raising Arizona, Flesh Lives, Ernest Goes to Jail.
Oh, he is in The Golden Child, isn't he? Yep. He was a skinnier guy back then.
He's been around. He hasn't done much lately, but he was around prevalent. You know, he's got about 33 or so credits to his name.
Is The Golden Child on our list?
I don't think it is.
Should be. Yeah. It's one of my favorite films of all time, Eddie Murphy.
If we went by should be, you realize how long our list would be.
That's one of the best Eddie Murphy movies, I think.
Yeah.
Golden Child, Coming to America, and Beverly Hills Cop, right?
Yeah.
Probably his three top.
Best one. Yeah. Nothing from anytime recently.
He did 48 Hours also, right?
Yeah, with Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah, nothing recent, though. Okay, so the other two actors in the cast that I want to bring up briefly. Nick Cassavetes, who's been in a number of films, especially earlier on, were the ones more memorable. He was TJ in Mask.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He was in Black Moon Rising. He was in The Wraith. And then he was in Face Off with Travolta and Cage.
The Wraith is randomly on Netflix, right?
Yeah, it's on a couple of other streaming options, too. But he became something of a fairly successful independent filmmaker later on, too. He plays kind of a crazy character in this called Kyle, which we'll get to. And then Sho Kasugi. He has about 2 minutes in this film. But what's important is...
Is he the sword fighter at the end?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was the assassin, as he's credited. No name. The assassin.
You gave me a real RoboCop 3 vibe.
Yeah. He had about 2 minutes...
Except he doesn't turn into a robot.
At the very end, right. But what's key is... He was behind the scenes. He is who. So Rutger Hauer talks about this being his most difficult role for two reasons. One, he spent about a month training with a blind judoku to learn how it is being blind, and then spent another week or two after that training in swordplay with Sho Kasugi. Sho Kasugi is one of the most prevalent stars that showed up in the 80s. There was tons of ninja movies in the 80s. American-made ninja movies in the 80s. Wow. He was probably the biggest star. He did.
Well, you say American-made, but a lot of that stuff was...
Well, but they were like films that we saw.
Yeah,
that
but a lot of the
heavily here.
A lot of those films were taken directly from footage shot in China or shot in Japan and re-edited and dubbed over in English.
Right. So not originally American-made, but very heavily distributed and marketed in the U.S. Yeah. From Enter the Ninja, Return the Ninja. Rage of Honor, and then most recently, if you remember, Ninja Assassin, that heavily CG movie. Which
I didn't see the movie, but
it was okay, but it was just like absurdly, grotesquely heavy on the CG.
Yeah.
CG blood spatters. It was pretty insane. But yeah, he's even though he has like 2 minutes in the end of the film,
He says that too, like that's going to be like this knockdown, drag-out fight.
And then the way he dies, like, what? Don't go on. But yeah, that covers the bulk of the cast. I mean, there's other players, but those are the main players.
Well, we didn't really give Rutger Hauer. I mean, for Rutger Hauer movie, we didn't really give him his just desserts here. I mean,
what's your favorite Rutger Hauer movie?
I definitely, I mean, it's just going to be the cliche. I mean, I don't think he's ever been cooler than he is in Blade Runner.
Yeah,
I mean, he is so Blade Runner's quintessential. He's so fucking good.
But like, I mean, Blade Runner is probably going to be everyone's answer. But like, with that assumption aside, can you pick one out?
I don't know. I'm looking through right now, and that's I mean, he's got.
I mean, personally,
he's one of those guys that's old as fuck now, but he just never stops. Yeah.
I mean, most recently he was in Batman Begins. He was in Sin City. Mm-hmm. He was in Surviving the Game, which is one of those Most Dangerous Game revisits. He was in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. He was Lothos. He was in The Hitcher.
God,
Lady Hawk.
The Hitcher is probably what a lot of horror fans would say.
Right. Personally, mine was a crossover of sci-fi horror. If my second favorite film of his, second to Blade Runner, that's Split Second.
Yeah, he's really good in Split Second.
Which we may or may not end up covering on this podcast. But yeah, he's been a pretty steady, what's the word I'm looking for here? Not someone that works a lot, but he works consistently and always does things that are different. You never see him do anything that's really par for the course.
I forgot he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. What is this? That's Tom Burton. I was going to say, what is this Tim Burton film called Beyond Justice? But that's Tom Burton.
That's another early 90s action stock.
It must be his little known brother. Tim Burton's little known action director.
Kind of like Ron Howard and what's his brother's name? Just those B horror movies.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I like him a lot, actually. Rutger Hauer was also in Salem's Lot, the TV series. TV he was really good in that.
Okay.
He was really good in that.
Yeah, a lot of love here for Rutger Hauer. And that's, like I said, that's part of the reason I selected this one in our top 10. Felt he needed a little recognition. So yeah, let's, we're ready to talk about the movie. Oh, well, let's go over some numbers real quick before we get into the story.
Let's get into that. I left that to you this week, so. Because we always end up talking over each other with these numbers anyway, so since this movie was your movie, I let you
go. I got it. So we got a current Rotten Tomatoes score.
Hang on. Yeah. Let me try to predict this.
Okay.
All right, Blind Fury.
All right.
1990, Rutger Hauer is going to give it points.
Okay.
Just for being Rutger Hauer.
I agree.
However, within the last few years, people will call it a cultural appropriation, so drop another point. I'm trying to do the social justice math on this movie. I'm going to say.
But he's not American originally.
In the mid 50s to.
He's European.
I'm going to say mid. Well, that gives it a few more points because American liberals love anything that's not American. I'm going to say mid 50s to mid 60s.
All right. Pretty good spot, 58%.
58%, okay, yeah.
Like we said, running time of 86 minutes, so it's a quick, painless movie.
I wouldn't say painless. There's a lot of pain in this movie.
Distributed by TriStar, which I have to point that out. I was talking about this with someone earlier. I was like, don't you miss back in the 80s and 90s when you put in a VHS and you have that logo come up with the music and there's those bits of music that you instantly recognize with a particular company.
Yeah, TriStar.
You just don't have that anymore.
Yeah, Vestron. You had all kinds of
different. Yeah, Columbia. And it's like a part of the VHS culture that we've lost.
Yeah.
But I always get a chill when I put in a VHS.
Miramax did their little.
One of the late 90s holdouts where they did that,
You remember what was probably the most dramatic one, I thought, was the late 90s, early 2000s Lionsgate, where they would literally have a gate, like gates.
Yeah, so the gears and stuff.
Yeah, that's
on the tail end where it got more fancy.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like the real basic late 80s, early 90s, the 80s style, like pre-digital graphics and everything,
Yeah, Canon was one of the big ones.
Oh, yeah. Oh, those were the days. I think I could just sit there and watch an hour of those spliced together.
So
we have an estimated budget of $10 million.
Seems a lie.
So, well, I don't know. Some of the locations I can understand costing some money, and then I'm sure Rutger Hauer wasn't cheap.
Random ski lift at the end was probably
that they shoot the hell out of.
Yeah, that's probably pricey.
Oh, something.
The casino.
Okay, so
is
I watched
pricey.
This with my wife, and she enjoyed this significantly more than she enjoyed Out for Justice. Okay. But she pointed something out that I had never thought about. I'm like, you have a good point. There's a lot of glass breaking in this movie. There's glass breaking all the time in this damn movie. And I was like, yeah, you have a point. I wonder if there's something about that. And she's going to kick me now because she actually gave me an explanation of why she felt that was important. Like, she read between the lines. She gave me this really good explanation of, like, her theory of why this was glass breaking. And I'm sorry, dear. I can't for the life of me right now remember that explanation.
I can't remember. You just said
that. She listens to the podcast.
This is like Tenacious D. This is a tribute to the greatest song in the world. This isn't it. This is just a tribute.
Maybe next episode I'll come back and I'll fill you in on the secret. But $10 million, it's a stretch, but I can kind of see where that could happen.
Gross.
The downside, opening weekend... You would go for opening weekend first?
$2 million.
Not even a million.
600,000.
868,000.
Wow. What did it open against?
Well, that's part of the issue. There's a lot of contention.
In 1990?
Mm-hmm. So, domestic gross. You want to try that real quick before
I'm
going
to say $10 million opened at.
This movie definitely meets our financial criteria for a cult film.
Well, that means it's a financial failure. So, I'm going to say $8 million.
2.7, just shy of $2.7 million.
It only ever made $2 million.
Wow! Yeah. So it only released in 353 theaters. It opening weekend alone is what other movies opened.
Are you sure
that,
this wasn't a re-release?
I verified it against both IMDb and Box Office Mojo with the same figures.
That's not a re-release.
It's not a re-release.
It didn't have the 89 where it had a bigger opening. You tell me. If
the live release on March 16, 1990 was only 353 theaters.
Well, that's not a wide release.
That's the widest release it had. That's everything in its entire
theatrical
run. So
this was one of those movies that definitely found its audience on cable.
Right, and the crazy thing is, this is a movie originally was written to have a sequel, which we'll get to with the ending, how it ends. And originally they planned on hopefully making this a Nick Parker is the name of the character Rakara plays. They had originally conceptualized this being a Nick Parker trilogy. Which is not uncommon for the source material.
Hey, why did we pass through the actors without talking about Terry O'Quinn?
Well, we can go back to him.
You don't think he deserves?
Oh, I think we definitely should.
He's goofy as fuck in this movie, but
and you don't recognize him until you take the hair away.
You gotta take the hair away,
and you realize he was John from Lost.
He's the dude from Lost.
But you know, he deserves more credit than that.
He was also very good in he's very TV.
Well, he's in one of your favorite movies.
Which one? Which one?
He was the sheriff in Silver Bullet.
That's right. And he's in. Isn't he the lead in the horror film Stepfather?
Yes, yes. He was also in Young Guns, and he was in The Rocketeer.
And he played one of the generals in The West Wing. He was in a lot of episodes of The West Wing.
But everyone knows him as John from Lost.
He's a very accomplished actor. But that was by far his biggest role.
My apologies
he ever
for
had
skipping
was,
over him. Yeah,
was John.
He
Locke.
Plays. Frank, John Locke's father in the movie. Yeah.
He's John Locke from Lost, the wheelchair-bound guy that says, "Don't tell me what I can't do," and never really pays off for him. He's a very sad demise in Lost, unfortunately.
But yeah, so let's get back to why this movie failed financially. So
one could say,
even if it was a re-release, its entire release of all theaters of all time was 353 theaters.
That's not very good.
Pittance. So opening weekend. It opened March 16th. The other three films that opened that same weekend alone, and we're going to get to what was already playing that weekend. You had Blue Steel, which is a Jamie Lee Curtis action film. That opened in 1,307 theaters. And that one opened just shy of $2.9 million.
Okay.
Then you had the Lord of the Flies remake that played 919 theaters. That one was number three opening weekend of all the films playing that weekend, and that one made $4.4 million opening weekend.
Now, is that the one we all saw as kids in school? So they would always, in school, they would make us read Lord
if
of the Flies.
If you had a cool teacher.
Well, we did.
No, this was the remake, not the original one.
Yeah. The remake in 1990, I was in. No, I was in high school, so it probably would have been
so
this
that
one.
Could see that if you
I think
had
it
cool
was 2000, no, not 2000, 19, probably 96. we read Lord of the Flies and then we watched the movie version. So I would say it's probably this.
Again, like I said, if you had a cool teacher.
Yeah. Was the original black and white?
Yeah.
No, we definitely watched one that was in color. Yeah.
And then the third film.
We didn't have a cool teacher, by the way.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, okay. Pretty well, you know what it is? They had looser standards.
Very much.
In school than they do today.
Very much so.
You wouldn't have a chance in hell of seeing this movie in school. And then finally, the other film that opened that weekend was Nuns on the Run. Remember that comedy? God. Action comedy? In air quotes, action comedy with Eric Idle and Robbie Coltrane. That was 702 screens. But okay, so that's just what opened that weekend, that same weekend. What was already playing? Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. Number one, I'm going to put it in the order that they ranked that opening weekend. Number one was Hunt for Red October. Okay. It was still playing. Then Joe vs. Volcano, which was actually a pretty popular Tom Hanks movie. Lord of the Flies remake, like I said, was third in box office. Then you had House Party.
Okay.
Kid and Play. Yeah. Then you had The Blue Steel, Jimmy Clark's movie. Then you had Driving Miss Daisy, number six. Then you had Bad Influence, number seven, which was which was Rob Lowe and James Spader. Then you have Lambada, which was a Latin dance drama. Yeah. Did better than Blind Fury.
Yeah. Lambada was that was the answer to Dirty Dancing, right? Everything became
sort of the Latin the Dirty Dancing,
the dance suspense.
No, you're gonna love this next one. So Lambada was number eight. You know what was number nine?
I do not.
Hard to Kill.
Nice.
Steven Seagal.
Nice, Steven Seagal.
Number 10 was Born on the 4th of July. Tom Cruise Oliver Stone film.
Yeah, that's a badass flick.
So then, where does Blind Fury come in? Blind Fury comes in, not number 11, but number 12 behind Madhouse, which was a John Larroquette, Kirstie Alley movie.
Wow.
So
did I ever see that? I was a big John Larroquette fan back then because of Night Court.
So I honestly think...
Kirstie Alley was big for Cheers.
Right. I honestly think timing hurt this film more than anything.
Well, a lot of things could hurt.
I'm not saying it's a perfect film, and I'm not saying it didn't have its flaws, but it was up against some pretty heavy contenders.
You notice how when it's your week, I try to dog your movie a little bit, try to get you to...
That's right. I'm sure you'll throw one in here once in a while that I got some dogging to do on. But yeah, so, you know... The movie had its work cut out for it. And needless to say, it definitely meets our financial criteria for being a cult film.
So it definitely found its feet on cable television.
Yep, and then it got DVD release.
I don't know if anybody watched the DVD, but everybody saw it on cable.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Oh, yeah.
That was
it was definitely a Showtime regular, or a premium cable regular, and then probably cable regular.
Absolutely. And I think the only versions I ever saw were the ones with sans... dismemberment.
Well, I argue that relatively speaking, this was not a terribly graphic.
Well, if you cut out
definitely
the,
not bloody film.
If you cut out the dismemberment, it doesn't have a lot.
It's ripe for cable TV play.
Yeah, very much so. And it was in constant rotation.
Oh, yeah.
This movie was on all the time when I was a little
kid. A lot like Steven Seagal films, the early ones. Okay, so we want to get into the film now, the actual story?
Yeah.
Okay. So as we had alluded to already, the film basically opens on a flashback. We go right into Vietnam, to the Vietnam War. May not necessarily be in Vietnam, but we go into Vietnam War. We're somewhere in Eastern Asia, in the jungle. And you see all this wreckage and flames and carnage laying around. Basically, it's the fallout. It's the aftermath of an attack, of a battle. And then we hear, we see some crawling around, and we hear... It's Rucker Howe crawling through the mud.
One of the things that I noticed right away from the opening scene is as we're like scanning past the bodies and it's clear that there's been like a helicopter crash is that all the bodies were intact. I was looking at it going, those should be
just bloody and on fire, but intact.
Those should be in pieces. But yeah, we get Rucker Howe going, I can't see.
So immediately we're like, okay, so this guy's blind. Enough said.
And clearly wasn't a moment ago.
Right. So we know how he became blind.
He passes out, or it goes fades to black.
Well, he's crawling through the mud, and then he gets to we see it coming, but of course he doesn't because he's blind. There's a tripwire.
Oh yeah, he gets caught up in a.
And he crawls right into it. He's caught up in a snare net, and then it cuts to basically he's got these like banana leaf or bamboo leaf like eye patches.
I'm not sure exactly what that's doing.
Was your first thought same as me? Your first thought was, oh, he's a POW, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
turns out a native tribe.
Well, my first question was, what the hell is that going to do for a blind guy?
Well, when you think about it, any, I don't know if this is what they do in real life, but any movie or TV show where someone's blinded in the hospital, they got some kind of bandage over their eyes. Well, they don't have. Well, they're not fucking gauze in the jungle.
Okay. All I'm saying is, his eyes weren't fucked up when he was scrawling around.
No, it was a flare blindness, like the flash blinded him.
In a lot of ways, when they have bandages on, their eyes get fucked up physically.
Right.
It was actually, it was the retina that was burned out from the flash bomb, which what I'm saying is, what the hell is bamboo?
Well, maybe it was holding some sort of natural salve that they came up with.
Who knows? But it does come off like he's a, because he gets caught up in the net, and you believe that he's a POW, and it turns out.
But in fact, a native tribe take him in and is healing him, and then there's this little tiny old native guy that ends up kind of helping him learn to get around and teaches him sword play and stuff.
Is the native guy Rambo-like? Is the native guy tiny, or is Rutger Hauer just a big dude?
I think it's a combination of the two, actually. Yeah. But it's very much accentuated.
Yeah.
Especially when they do their little swordplay dance together.
Yeah, when they're dancing.
But,
they do their dirty dancing.
But basically, that's how, you know, he takes him under his wing and teaches him how to survive and how to use a sword and everything. And he seems very kind of content. The way the montage works, you can tell he's been there for a while.
Well, his beard and hair get longer and longer. And the way that, and all montages have a central theme. Mm-hmm. The theme of this montage is that they are trying to teach him how to slice melons in the air with his with a cane sword. Uh-huh. And he can't do it. And they're making fun of him, and they hit him in the face.
It's like that scene in Star Wars where Obi-Wan's trying to teach him how to use the Force, and he blindfolds him, and he can't, you know, he's got the little ball that's shooting the little blaster beams, and he can't deflect them.
And so each time we get a little further in time in the montage, Rutger Hauer's hair gets a little longer, his beard gets a little longer, and he gets a little better at the sword fighting until the very last part of the montage. He's able to
perfectly quarter slice the melon
in the air, totally blind. And starting without the stick is in the case,
right? From the sheath, yeah.
Pulls it out of the sheath.
He does
slices.
It a very cool, underhand way,
So then it cuts to
he's walking along
Southern
the highway.
Florida. It cuts to
Miami, Florida.
Gives you a little.
He's walking along the highway. All you see is feet. He's wearing these dirty old chucks, and then it slowly pans out from his feet. He's wearing an overcoat, and then you see he's got his cane. And he's got a red ball cap, and he's sunglasses, and he's wearing Walkman. And, which I always wonder, like, is he actually listening to anything, or is it just a distraction?
It comes off to me more as a distraction, but again, it's one of those things where it's like...
Because he relies on his sound, so...
It's so... This whole, like, I'm an unassuming, goofy guy, but I'm really a stone-cold killer. It's really under... The character itself is underplayed. So it's hard to say, but my guess is he's like trying to wear a goofy outfit so people think that he's a goofy guy. But
just to further sell the I'm blind bit.
I get it, but like, to what end?
I mean, yeah, I get what you're saying.
I'm just saying, story-wise, there's not really any reason for him to want to be unassuming and goofy and have people pick on him and have to pretend to accidentally beat them up. It's like he's under no restrictions from anyone. He's not serving any master. He's not running from the law. Well, he's not, you know, he just sort of does it because, like you said, it's a nod to the source material.
Right or wrong, and again, I'm getting you probably haven't seen any of Zatoichi, and I'm guessing most people see this movie haven't seen any of Zatoichi. But I have to go back to it because the character in Zatoichi very much is the same thing. He's much more capable as a blind man than he leads on. He's constantly acting like he stumbles around, doesn't know what's going on. You know, reverse hustles everyone. He gambles frequently. He likes to gamble in the original.
Which comes into play later in this movie as well.
Yeah.
Randomly. It doesn't serve the purpose of the script.
It doesn't,
It just happens, and it's just another one of those moments where it's like, people think I'm goofy, but I'm really a badass. It's like there's a lot of moments in the movie where people think he's goofy and he turns out to be a badass. I'm just saying, as far as why he has to play up the goofiness, there's not really any reason why he should have to play up the goofiness.
It's like someone just said, it's like the writer just said, okay, this would be a cool idea for a scene. Let's throw
Whereas, with maybe the source material, it has more to do with he's goofy to bring people's guard down so he can hustle them, but Rutger Hauer isn't a hustler. In fact, his only mission here is he's trying to find his friend, the explosive expert, played by Terry O'Quinn, who blinds him accidentally and runs off and leaves him for dead.
Right.
He's trying to find him so he can forgive him. And so he walks up. Well, actually, it cuts from him walking down the street to Las Vegas, Nevada.
Right.
And do we get into the bar scene?
The bar scene comes real early because he's sitting there. He's going to have his burrito. And you got the local thug that comes up and says, hey, man, you want some hot sauce with that? He gives it some sort of colorful name.
Well, and that's another one of those things. Where, I don't know. I'm not going to bash this whole movie.
It's not what we're here to do, Kevin.
But it's just those guys, the whole scene, I was thinking to myself,
very stereotypical.
I was like, why are they, to what end are they being such assholes? Like, this guy immediately walks up to him and is just like, right. I'm going to fuck with this guy
I will hand it to you. This movie is very heavy on the, hey, I'm blind.
So everybody in the world fucks with me.
And it's true. Everybody fucks with the blind guy in this movie.
Even the little kid.
Even the little kid. The kid is the biggest asshole in this whole movie. Initially. Until he accepts him as, quote unquote, Uncle Nick. This kid is the biggest asshole in this whole movie.
Which is a long way into this very short film.
But yeah, so in the bar scene, this guy is going to pick on the blind guy. He's like, hey, you want a little hot sauce on there? He says, yeah, do you want the hot or the really, you want the mild or the really hot? So just the mild. So what does he do? He doesn't just put the really hot on there. He puts, like, a ton of hot sauce on there. So then Nick Ruckerhauer, of course, he rolls up his burrito and takes a bite. And he goes, ah. And, like, it's really hot. And then he's like, okay. You know, he just plays off like, okay, no big deal. It's hot, you know. And
very goofy.
Very goofy. But then shortly thereafter, the same thug and his little cronies, like in a grade school play yard, have this lady's purse and are tossing it around, right?
And ends up at Ruckerhauer's feet.
And Ruckerhauer, being the good guy that he is, it comes to his feet and he says, hey, give me that purse. And his line is, his retort is basically, are you sure it'll go with your dress? And of course, that pisses the thug off. So they're all like, okay, blind guy, there's six of us, throw down, buddy. It's like, really? And they're like, what are you going to do? And of course, he in turn kicks their asses, but he does so kind of Jackie stands at Tweetsie style. Like, it's all everything. He's just stumbling around making mistakes, but it still looks cool. It's still fun.
So then it cuts to Las Vegas, Nevada, and right. Terry O'Quinn is being held upside down mm-hmm. by the people who turn out to be the big bads of the film, or the they don't really, again, they don't have any real reason to be bad guys. They just are.
Well, they are. We don't know what their primary purpose is. Like, what kind of, are they?
They're just thugs.
Are they what?
Yeah, they're just thugs. They're Vegas thugs, and they want because. Terry O'Quinn is an explosives expert. He's, I guess, a chemist now.
He's an organic chemist.
In his civilian life, and they want him to make meth for him.
Yeah,
and he doesn't want to do it, so they basically hang him out to dry off the top of the roof of a casino, and then they threaten his wife and kid back in Florida.
Well, his ex-wife and kid, yeah.
And then it cuts back to
What we find out later on is that. The reason they're wanting to do this is...
Why are we going later on?
Oh, well, okay, good point. So, it cuts back to...
Florida.
Yeah, it cuts back to Florida, and...
we're at his ex-wife's house. We're at Meg Foster's.
Right, this is where he shows up. And a convoluted scene, but it's sweet. He's walking along, and then you see Billy. We haven't met Billy yet, but we see Billy upstairs in his room. He's, like, sculpting this clay... Play-Doh dinosaur or whatever, and he bumbles it, and it falls out his window and down, and Nick hears it and catches it. And so then that just happens to be the house he's going to, and he walks in, and Meg Foster opens the door as Lynn, the mom. And he goes in, explains who he is, they sit down, have a nice little conversation, and then that's when they get a knock on the door.
And it ends up being, it's cops, but they're really aggressive, and they're really... kind of being assholes.
Clearly corrupt.
Cops. They're looking for Billy. Mm-hmm. And then here comes... what's his name?
Yeah, when that doesn't go over well because Nick inherently senses something's not right, then in walks Tex Cobb, which is... His name in the movie is Slag.
Slag. Which is, so in walks Slag. Slag doesn't like what he hears.
He's a no bullshit kind
one
of
thing,
guy.
One thing leads to another. He shoots...
Almost immediately pulls out a shotgun and shoots up to the side.
And she falls over.
Well, it's the beginning of the end.
It ends up being a really cool action scene, and that's the thing that saves this film, I think, from having really kind of a goofy story. Mm-hmm. Is these sequences, and this is what I remembered as a kid, was all these sequences. Is they really do well with Ruckerhauer and his and all of his blind
sword play
fights. So he instantly, one of the corrupt cops, or even if he is a cop, I don't think they're cops, I think they're just wearing cop uniforms.
Yeah.
But one of them, you know, points his gun at him, and Rutger Hauer just whoosh, cuts his hand off, and very graphically you see the hand bounce the off the ground, and then he runs off into the other room, ends up slashing and cutting everybody up, and he ends up letting Slag live, but what he does with him is he Slag walks around with these mini cigars.
Not just long cigars.
They're long, but they're mini. They're thin. Skinnies, long, skinny cigars, and he ends up cutting the cigar in half and letting him live, mm-hmm. and Slag runs off. I forget what his line is.
Well, he's, I don't know if it was here or later on, but he says, one of the better lines in the movie, he says, not bad for a not blind bad, guy, yeah, not but bad that butter knife isn't going to stop a bullet.
Yeah, and that's what he says in that scene. And then he runs off, and then there's Meg Foster sort of has her...
her death scene.
And at some point, Billy got knocked out during the...
Well, and what's important in the story is she makes Nick promise to take him. Billy to Reno to basically let his dad take care of him.
And again, for reasons never... expressed in the film, Nick is just a great guy, and he's just going to do that. He's if you're Dungeons and Dragons, he is there's neutral, and then there's chaotic, and then there's
remember he's
just
the new Nick, not the old Nick.
So you have those; these are your different personality types. You have neutral, you have chaotic, or you have just, and then you have evil, and you have good. And the most good you could be, which would be like a paladin, a knight in the Dungeons and Dragons world, where he lives by a code of honor, whether it be his own code or the code of his king, and he never breaks that code. And anytime moral ambiguities come up, he always skews on the side of what's right by his moral code. Nick lives in that justice good side. So he's all the way. So if you're looking at it in a big square with neutral in the middle, he's up top to the left, all the way as far as it goes. And again, there's no real reason given for why he's such a good person, but that's just how he's going to play throughout this film. Every opportunity he gets to do the right thing, he does the right thing. So immediately, as soon as she dies, his only goal for the rest of this film is to get Billy to his father at all costs. And that's never questioned, and never for a moment is his goal ever going to...
Never wavers. That's he's focused, laser focused. And so immediately from there, we cut to the bus station, and it's raining cats and dogs. And this is where it was a little Hallmark cheesy, but I thought it was a fun scene where we touched on earlier with The Rock.
Yeah.
Billy's still being a total dick.
Well, Billy wakes up and he's like, "Where's my mom? Right, I don't want to go see my dad."
But granted, he just been, you know, he doesn't really know what happened.
Yeah, he has no idea his mom's dead.
He's like, "I don't know what's going on."
And Nick isn't telling him that his mom's dead.
Right.
He's just telling him about
understandably, right now, their goal is to get where they're going, and then everything will be revealed. That's the way it's intended to go. So there's this rainstorm. They're getting on the bus, and he's being difficult. Billy's being difficult. So, Nick slips in the mud and falls. Billy laughs at him, like the bully little asshole that he's being. But then Karma immediately catches up with him, and as he goes to catch up, then Billy himself slips and falls in the mud, and Nick has his laugh.
So again, the scene is so weird because you've got this guy that's like, he is a bona fide badass martial artist, has control of all, you know, physically a master, and he slips in the mud. And it's not just a slip in the mud, it is a pratfall. His legs come out from under him, and he slams on his back in the mud. And at first, when I was watching this, I was like, he did it on purpose to get a laugh out of Billy. But then, no, he really just slipped and fell on his ass in the mud.
It's okay, Billy went face first, got a mouthful of mud.
He did. But then
he also gets it, because that's when the rock candy, as I call it, scene comes up where he picks up a rock out of the mud and offers it as candy to Nick. Nick takes it, crunches, sees it's a rock, but swallows it anyway. But then, as Billy's laughing, immediately regurgitates and spits it like a bullet at Billy's forehead.
You took it like that. I took it as though he was pretending the whole time. He didn't actually bite it. He didn't actually swallow it.
Yeah, I can
see
just
wanted to get Billy to laugh so he could spit a rock in his fucking face.
He spit it hard, too. If you remember, there was a purple welt immediately.
Which, again, is just this whole scene I'm just playing out. Like, I'm like, is this dude the baddest dude on the planet, or is he this goofball clown? The movie plays it back and forth.
Could be both.
Very, very much so. Throughout the whole film, in fact. He never stops being both a clowny, goofy dude and the baddest dude in the film.
So they're on the bus. They're on the bus ride, and Billy is kind of rummaging through Nick's stuff, and he comes across this old photo from the war, which was Nick and Frank together, and he asks him. So Nick begins kind of telling some of the back history, and then slips into the second flashback of the film, which gives us a little more detail of their history in terms of what happened that led to his blindness and everything. And then we end up in Kansas, and they're at a gas station truck stop or whatever. They get out in Kansas, and basically it leads to we get the return of Tex.
Yeah, this is the scene. This is a badass scene. It ends up, this is the scene where Rutger, because Billy goes to call his mom.
Right.
And Rutger Hauer basically tells, like, we got to talk about something. I got to tell you this. Right. Your mom's fucking dead. These guys fucking killed her. And of course, Billy reacts. This film is very similar to Over the Top, isn't it?
In a lot of ways,
scene where Stallone has to tell the kid that the mother has died. In the hospital, and he blames Stallone for not being able to see her one last time because they were dicking around.
He could have just flown
home. And in this film, Billy just doesn't want to hear the news, so he takes off running into the cornfield.
Right.
Well, that's when Slag's boys are out there. Now, I want to mention something. This is a pretty good time to mention that, again, the writing in this film, for whatever reason, the writer has a hard-on for rednecks. Every single villain in this film is a redneck.
Well, you know, the first redneck local heads. Hired gun, quote unquote, that we see Howard kill, he's a big fat guy in overalls, and he didn't have a gun or a weapon. Do you remember what he's holding when he dies?
No.
Big old long paper sleeve of popcorn.
Yeah, that's right. No, he doesn't have a gun. He's got a gun.
Well, he dropped it earlier. Okay. Yeah. But when he kills him, he's holding on to one of those big, long paper sleeves of popcorn in the middle of a cornfield. He gets killed.
And it's actually, this is another one of those scenes where, like, once this film kicks into action, it ain't playing around.
No, it's not.
He's running through the cornfields, and he's fucking these dudes up who all happen to be rednecks wearing cowboy hats for some reason. I mean, they're in Kansas, so I suppose that's... Right. But once they're in Las Vegas...
Yeah, Reno.
Is it Reno?
Yeah.
Once they're in Reno, what is the point of all these cowboys? But anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, they gotta have somebody as cannon fodder.
it's just odd to me that it's all rednecks.
He takes out all these rednecks, and then he finally
gets... So anyway, Tex is... He throws Billy into a shed type thing. And then, which is actually a clever move for Slag, he crawls up on the roof, and he's going to... And he's going to shoot Rutger Hauer as soon as he sees him. Somehow, blind Rutger Hauer anticipates this and is able to fashion a crude scarecrow with his hat and jacket on. So he keeps popping it up, getting Slag to waste his bullets and to get close enough to him that he's able to... he actually runs up and slashes the support post out, and it causes the whole thing to go crashing down. And he does attack Slag at this point and slice him up a bit, but he doesn't kill him for whatever reason.
Right. So the way the movie plays out, what happens is, if you're seeing it for the first time, minor spoiler alert, he's essentially left for dead. We assume that's the end of Tex. Okay. So, from here, we return to Reno, Nevada.
We're going to do everything? Are we going to do this scene by scene?
Oh, we can, yeah. What am I leaving out?
No. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Is this really worthy of scene by scene?
Because this is where we meet MacReady. Really meet him.
Right, which is...
Okay, and this is where we get the explanation of what they're doing with Frank.
Yeah. Okay.
So we meet MacReady, who is kind of the boss guy. And he's very nervous. He's talking about this drug deal. He's very nervous. And what he explains is, apparently there's some sort of a real estate transaction where he's got a big loan. And in order for him to make the loan payment in time, he needs this drug dealer to go through, which is what he needs Frank for, to make these designer drugs, meth, or whatever the blue stuff is he's making.
Right.
Which I immediately thought of Breaking Bad, but this is Breaking Bad. So he's basically at the point, and one of my favorite little bits of dialogue comes out here. He's at the point, he's like, we need, whoever this blind asshole is, we need to stop him, find him, kill him. well, he's taking out all our guys. I don't care. Get Bruce Lee. And the right. other guy, Cobb, he's like, well, Bruce Lee's dead, boss. I don't care. Give me his brother.
It's really, really funny.
And he's like, and which kind of foreshadows the assassin role that comes in later.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's like, we need to get rid of this guy. You know, in a very, again, Steven Seagal movie fashion. This guy's, this one guy's causing all problems. It's one guy was killing, right?
Lots of action movies have that line in it.
So then we go back to Kansas, and moving forward, it's still part of this road trip for Nick and Billy. And then
this is kind of like it's a road trip movie.
Right.
It's a comedy.
It's a lot of things.
It's a very graphic action movie. Definitely the road trip part of it is another one of those things where, as a kid, I didn't remember it being such a road trip movie. But
yeah,
this is so. About the time where the two big doofuses.
Yeah, this is where Lyle and Tector, which is an interesting name.
Tector.
They're brothers or cousins, who knows.
And their demise is one of the weirdest things I've ever seen on film. They don't.
Well, before we get to that, because they go to Frank's place. They finally get there, and that's where they meet Annie, and it ends up being an ambush. Yeah. Lyle and Tector are there waiting for him. knock Nick out.
So Nick and the kids show up. Right. And what is Annie's relation?
She's friends with, or she's connected to Frank.
And somehow Nick had been in contact with her and knew they were on their way. Yeah. And so she invites them in, and it turns out that Lyle and Tector are waiting and they end up. Debilitating.
Right. They knock out Nick and they take Billy.
Which again, and this happens to Rutger Hauer so many times in the film. Right. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, is he a bad motherfucker or is he a goofy ass clown?
Right. Somehow he doesn't see this coming.
Because when they hit him in the head, he spins towards the camera and gives this goofy pratfall and goes crashing to the ground. So we've now seen him pratfall at least two or three times in this.
So they tie up Nick and they throw Nick and Billy in the back of this van.
Right.
And sitting up front, facing the opposite way, was kind of weird. So, like, sitting on the center console is Annie between
the two. She gave me a real April O'Neil vibe. She was really, really sexy in this.
Yeah. She's obviously not a bad person. She's coerced into doing what she's doing for whatever reason.
What I thought was really cool, because again, this is another really cool action scene after a really goofy pratfall scene. And it's just back of this film is just all over the place. Mm-hmm. But they end up throwing they've got his
cane sword up front
and whichever one it is, Tector or Lyle, is playing with it, and it ends up unlocking it, and he's like, oh, would you look at this, motherfucker's got a sword.
He puts his thumb on it.
Yeah, he puts his thumb, he's like, oh my god,
and it cuts him. And so he says this damn thing's cursed because the sword cuts him.
And he throws it out the window, and then Nick does the coolest thing.
Nick hears it.
Yeah, and he does the coolest thing. He starts having Billy count
out loud
from that moment, and he says, don't stop counting until we stop. And I was like, oh, that is awesome, because it just foreshadows what's about
to
happen.
And then as he's counting, he walks him through how to get out of his bindings.
Yeah. And I like the line, because Billy's like, I can't. And he goes, well, then we're dead.
Right. And then the kids look on it's the one bit of good acting for the kid. The look on his face is like, oh, well, fuck, I guess I can.
So they get him out of the bindings, and Nick, in the meantime, lights something on fire in the back. And they're like, oh, smell smoke. Oh, and they pull out the gun, and they go run around and park the van.
And Nick, in turn, does essentially exactly them what they did to him.
Knocks him out with the van doors as he gets to the back. And then the funny scene happens, because they at this point they think Annie's a bad guy.
Right.
So they jump in the front, and they both say at the same time, who's going to drive?
And she runs around and says, I'm driving.
And
then they tell her to go back, and she's like, why?
So she turns the truck around, and then he has Billy start counting backwards from, he got to 30.
Right.
He has him start counting backwards, and they stop in the general vicinity of where the sword
Billy
is.
Finds the cane sword.
Which I thought was cool, but at the same time, it's another one of those things where it's like, so is Rutger Hauer helpless without this thing? Like, all you got to do is get
rid of
this.
Well, but it goes back to your goofy argument, too, because after he finds the sword and runs up, she ends up dropping her glasses.
And then he steps on him, but Nick, I think I found
your glasses. Oh, no, I can't drive without my glasses. So who ends up driving?
And to me, this is one of the weakest scenes in the film, is because they end up downtown, whatever, I guess they're in
Reno
by this time, and he's got him they've got him driving the wrong way on a one-way street. Nick's driving blind. Of course, they are just fine.
He's laughing, almost having a good old time the whole time, while Billy and Annie are nervous wreck.
They end up almost hitting a wall. There's actually, you remember the trauma car flip? mm-hmm. from the trauma films.
That's how Kyle and yeah. and Tector lose. They lose
Lyle them. And Tector yeah. end up, they're following in the van.
Typical 80s, 90s action movie.
But they hit a car mm-hmm. and do the flip. Yep. And it almost, and I think it's even the same style of car as the trauma car flip.
Yeah.
I mean, it is eerily similar to the trauma car
flip. Well, you know, after that, immediately after that happens, they go through and then the two cars collide.
Yeah.
A little bit of trivia. That collision between those two cars at the end of that scene was
killed the stunt guy in the car.
No.
R.I.P. Bob Smith.
It was not planned. It was a literal accident.
There are a few movies like that that the stunt guy fucking dies.
Absolutely. But to my knowledge, no stuntman died in this movie. But two cars bit it unexpectedly, but they liked how it looked so well, they kept it in the film.
Oh, that's cool.
So that was a little bonus.
Do we have any car chase films in our top 100? Like Vanishing Point or Gone in 60 Seconds.
I don't think. Oh god, I love one of my favorite films. Actually, I really enjoy, for better or for worse, I really enjoy the remake.
Get out of here, the Nicolas Cage remake.
But no, it's something like the original. But anyway,
was it Angelina Jolie and Nick Cage?
Yeah,
get out of here.
I love it. I don't know why. I think it's a great movie. Fun movie, not great movie. Fun movie. But yeah, so I found that it was interesting.
How do we not have car chase movies on our...
That's what we're saying, man. There might be. It's 100 movies, man. We don't have to look at it again.
We always look at it again. We look at it again
this is going to evolve so many times. But
yeah, we look at it like it's a foreign thing. Like, neither one... Who picked these movies?
We did. Oh, damn.
So, anyway.
Oh, I have to go back. Remember where Kyle and... There's a lot of assholes in this movie. Remember how Kyle and Tector get their...
Isn't it Lyle?
Lyle, yeah. Lyle and Tector get their car for the chase.
Yes, they drag two old ladies
out of the car. Out of the car and look on the side
and
of the
road. He says something like,
well, get the Tector was actually trying to be nice. Lyle ends up like, being an asshole. Get the hell out of the car.
Doesn't he call her a battle axe?
Something like that.
Jesus.
Oh, a whole lot of nice people in this movie. So the chase scene ends, they get away, and then that's where they end up.
Well, at the end of the chase scene, he goes, oh, I should get my license again.
Right. This is the best time of his life. He's laughing and smiling, having a good old time. There's another bit of dialogue that was funny. One guy pulls up next to him and yells at him, hey, what are you, blind? He goes, yeah, what's your excuse? The guy's like, holy shit! But from here, we get to the casino. Jeez. Which, as you said, doesn't really have any
purpose. So we finally get to the casino.
Right.
And so... what's his name in the film? Terry Oquin.
Frank.
So Frank is upstairs, and it is in the casino, right? Isn't he making drugs in the casino?
Upstairs in the hotel room. But first, he's in the casino. That's where he plays the roulette.
No. I'm not talking about Nick. I'm talking about
Frank. Yeah, Frank. He's upstairs. Yeah.
So Frank's upstairs, and that's where the bad guy that has to have the loan and the drugs and everything. And for whatever reason, Nick is. They get to the hotel to find Frank, and he decides to play some roulette, and he's
cleaning up.
Because apparently blind people can hear the way the ball falls. I don't know. It doesn't matter. So they end up, he's making so much money, they bring the cleaner over. Isn't that what they call him, cleaners?
The manager.
Yeah. They bring the cleaner over, and the cleaner basically cheats. And can magnetically pick which number it's going to fall on. But Nick can hear the beeping of the device in his pocket. Right. And so he dramatically takes out the sword knife, the sword stick, and slashes the little beepy thing open. And it's right underneath his name tag. And then he flips over the table, right. And the corresponding
and you can see the magnetic little device under there,
thing
yeah.
is under there. And so in order
and
to get
gamblers,
away...
the gamblers, they're in riot.
The gamblers are enraged, and
which
they flip
I
out.
Just found out why he did it. Or maybe what led to him doing it. Well, whether it was intentional or not, it created a distraction. Which does pertain
the distraction
to
allows
his
him
goal.
To go upstairs.
Now, whether he went in intending that or not...
But it's not much of a distraction because, like, right away, whenever he gets to the elevator doors, Lyle and Tector are already after him.
Yeah, but he basically gets them stuck in the elevator.
So he gets them stuck in an elevator with another couple guys,
yeah.
And he's able to get up to Frank's room. But Frank's not in the room when he gets there. Does he even get there?
Well, he gets up there, and this is where he meets Cobb. That's right. When he does the Cobb, which is kind of MacReady's Red Hand Man? Mm-hmm. He masterfully slices off his bushy eyebrows.
Oh, yeah. He kicks his door open, and he's threatening him, and he says, and then he has another one of his one-liners where he says, you're going to want to take some aspirin for that headache. He says, what headache? And he jumps on the table and smacks him in the head.
Well, actually, you know what line he says when when Nick first walks in? He says, you're like a one-man you're like a one-man walking commercial to hire blind people.
Yeah. To hire handicapped people.
Right? And then when he continues being a hard ass, clearly not going to be helpful or giving him information, that's when Nick takes to, carefully remove his eyebrows, his bushy old man eyebrows, and they fall on his desk. And then that's what. Then from there, Tex returns again.
Yeah.
And ends up taking Billy. Now this is a separate.
You keep calling him Tex.
Right. Yeah. I keep calling him Tex.
Slag. I mean, if they're gonna give them names like Slag right. and Tector, we gotta use the names.
So Slag returns, ends up taking Billy, and then so this leads to the infamous ski lift scene, where Nick and Frank board the ski lift. Which they're kind of sitting ducks, which of course leads to an ambush where
they have a little heart to heart. Frank says, "I thought you were dead all these
years." This is where the official forgiving takes place, which
I
is
trying
kind
to
of,
find you all these years, so I can tell
he's
you.
He's surprised that Nick's still alive,
and that's necessary not just to tie up why he did all this to begin with, but what's going to happen here in a few minutes.
Right.
So they get to the top of the thing. The Slag and all the other rednecks, again, they're all wearing cowboy hats for some reason. I guess Reno, Nevada might be a big cowboy town or something.
They have a big shootout.
They blow that thing to shit, and then they go in and look around only to find that they had taken a trap door out of the bottom of it into whatever the fuck they... inside the right. inner workings
the
of the casino.
They took it up to the top of this like mountain cliff.
Yeah, and there's some kind of a compound up there that I guess belongs to the bad
guys. Where MacReady, the boss guy.
So they end up, all the bad guys end up cornering them. Mm-hmm. And as the shooting starts, Frank leaves Nick again.
Hightails and
bails. He has a flashback of when
this
happened.
That
in the war, which left him blind and left for dead, and. Damned if Frank didn't do it all over again.
Right.
And so Nick ends up taking out the bad guys, and he's sort of in a pickle, and then bang! Frank's back, and he's throwing his homemade
bombs.
So he didn't actually abandon him this time, or maybe he did.
Well, he
had second thoughts.
I think his instinct kicked in, and then realized that he was about to fuck Nick again. And he couldn't
so he
do
came
that,
back,
and he came back,
and this all leads to them in the final. Mm-hmm. They've got Billy upstairs with Slag, and and the main bad guys, and Nick walks in. Well, I don't remember what the hell happens to Frank during this.
I don't remember if he got knocked out or what.
He's conveniently misplaced.
He's conveniently not essential to this end fight scene.
So does he take out Slag first and then they call him?
No. Yeah. The assassin is brought in first.
Oh, and we completely missed the Lyle and Tector finale. Before they got to the ski lift. Rutger Hauer ends up getting them to pull guns on him, and he sort of steps out of the way, and either Lyle or Tector, one or the other, shoots the one in the chest, and as a response, the one that got shot. He's like, come on, bro. And he shoots the other one in the head, and they both die.
Fitting.
They both die. You're saying fitting, but it's like, is this a goofy comedy? These people are dead.
They those characters from beginning to end were played completely goofy.
And then died, and then murdered each other. Oh, Lord. So we're up here, and they call in the, bring him in.
And so you've got this very well-dressed Japanese man who's maybe middle-aged, and he draws his sword, and I forget what happens, but Nick does something that immediately impresses the assassin, and he gives this, kind of a thing. It was a very stereotypical nod and vocal gesture of approval, like, oh, challenge,
So they have this cool sword fight, and again, the fighting in this movie is fantastic. fantastic.
Absolutely.
Fantastic fighting around a goofy-ass flick, but they end up cutting up one of the lighting fixtures.
Right,
and the lighting
which falls into the hot tub, which is right smack dab in the center of the room.
Why they're in the hot tub room is anybody's guess, but it ends up electrifying the water.
So you got this boiling hot tub of water.
And so the ninja assassin, for whatever
reason... Not foreshadowing at all.
For whatever reason, decides to jump up on the this piece of
hanging scaffolding. Well, he's blind, so he's going to get the jump.
And he's going...
See what I did there? Yeah. Get the jump on Nick.
He jumps up on this hanging scaffolding and tries to swing
over... I swear it almost looks like a trapeze.
He's literally hanging like a trapeze. He swings over to try to fuck up Nick.
But Nick's super hearing kicks in.
And so he's able to slash the trapeze off of the scaffolding and drops the ninja assassin
directly into the electrified hot tub. End of story.
And kills him.
And he drops his sword.
So then the bad guy is like, take care of this! And Slag...
Re-enter Slag.
Slag shows back up with his shotgun.
His trusty shotgun. And so Nick is standing there with a sword, and so harkening back to his original bit of dialogue, Slag then shoots the sword.
Yeah, knocks it into
shoots it out of his hand. And drops told it. You the butter knife wasn't going to be worth anything.
And it falls into the electrified water, so Nick can't touch it. But the ninja sword is out of the water, so he grabs that.
He grabs that.
Kills.
Now this is key. I want us to dwell on this final death scene because he's been trying so hard to kill Slag. He wanted to say Tex, goddammit. he's been trying to kill Slag, and Slag just won't fucking die. And so, when you really, in your mind's eye, revisit this death scene and tell me if it doesn't remind you of something. Alright, I'm going to paint you a picture here. Star Wars, almost said Star Trek. Star Wars, Episode 1.
Oh yeah! Absolutely. Okay, so, and I said that out loud when I was watching the film earlier. I was like, "What are you getting at? What are you talking about?" Totally said it out loud when I was watching the film earlier. So Nick runs up and he's like, and slashes. And there's a lot of moments in this film where he slashes people, and it takes a minute for something to happen.
Right.
So what's awesome about this is at about the same rate that the character goes flying out of the window in RoboCop from being shot to death. Slag goes flying out the window at a high velocity, and as you see him falling down the mountain, he fucking splits in half like Darth Maul from Star Wars Episode 1. And it's a really cool scene, and again, super violent for such a goofy movie.
Pretty sure Slag is dead this time. Unless if we follow the Clone Wars animated series and Slag comes back with a robotic spider lower half.
Yeah, and totally insane from living underground for 20 years or however long he was down there. So you have a movie where Rutger Hauer is doing pratfalls in the mud and slashing dudes in half and killing them as they hurl.
Slashing hands off.
Oh, man. What are your final thoughts?
Just real quick to close the movie out. So Billy and Frank end up boarding the bus to go to San Francisco, and they want to come along, but Nick stays behind, and Billy gets all emotional because now he's Uncle Nick. Maybe ten minutes ago is when he first started calling him Uncle Nick, very far into this, not treating him like an asshole. But Nick stays behind me, and basically the gist is, you know, I've done what I needed to do to mend this relationship with Frank. You guys go live your life together, and I'll live mine, because my life is apparently that of a wandering loner. And the concept here is that Nick walks off alone into the sunset along the highway as a drifter to set up for a sequel that was originally planned but never went anywhere because this movie made shit. And even back further, as we talked about, the original concept was for this to be a Nick Park trilogy, which I would have loved to see. But when you make shit...
You might be the only person that wanted another Nick Park movie after that.
So, you were asking what my overall thoughts on the movie were? Okay. I agree with your thoughts on it being awkwardly goofy at times. And I agree, it's not a well-written movie, but I love the concept and I love what they attempted to do.
I mean, it was
I think Rutger Hauer did just fine. I think for what it was and what he had to work with, I love Rutger Hauer's performance in this movie.
He's one of those actors that doesn't have a bad performance.
Right, exactly. I love seeing Tex. I always love seeing Meg, even if it is only for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I just like what they did with it. Again, you don't see a lot of crossovers like this, so you kind of got to take what you can get. I'm going to tangent for just half a moment here. And it's going to take twisting your arm quite a bit for us to do it. I would love to address a film called Red Sun. It's from the 70s. It's a crossover Western samurai film. With that said, look it up. It's hard to find, but it's a great movie. But it's one of those crossovers. Like, how many crossover Western samurai films are there?
Well, there's Robert Ford was actually... Was it Robert Ford? Robert Ford was a... Was it Kurosawa? Kurosawa was a big Ford fan.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote his samurai films as a response to Ford's...
In which several American Westerns played off of Kurosawa's films.
And so there was an incestuous relationship between Westerns.
Even George Lucas was inspired by Kurosawa's films. With Star Wars, elements of Star Wars. But yeah. I loved seeing the interplay between the East and the West. And so this is one of those... And again, I wanted to pick a movie that wasn't like an obvious choice. So this is one that's out there that a lot of people know about, but that not everyone's aware of. But yeah, I enjoy it. It's a fun movie. It's a short watch. It's an easy watch. It's a fun movie. It's only 86 minutes. And can you dispute that you had fun?
It was a fun movie.
It was very fun.
John Ford, not Robert Ford.
Yeah, John Ford.
John Ford.
Robert Ford is the coward that killed.
Yeah. It was bugging me because I knew that. I was like, I don't think this is the same guy.
What's an example of an excellent movie, but that is not short and is not fun?
Not short,
but it's an excellent movie.
No, I had a lot of fun with Blind Fury.
The title takes you 5 minutes to recite, it's a long movie.
I would not put Blind Fury in the top 10 of a cult film list, but...
Two for two now, you can see I'm always going to go with the dark horse.
No, listen, I when it all was all said and done, I had no problem with putting A Boy and His Dog up here in the top 10. Mm. No problem with it. That's fine.
Fine, let me make this final argument.
I am still scratching my head on Blind Fury, though.
Okay, I'm going to make this final argument. Siskel and Ebert gave Blind Fury 2 thumbs up.
Hey, you know, Siskel and Ebert liked it. Siskel and Ebert are both dead, by the way, so...
This is true. Both from cancer, too, sadly.
I don't know what that has to do.
That has absolutely nothing to do with us.
Well, we got one more question to answer before we get out of here.
Okay, what question is that?
How the fuck are you going to get Blind Fury?
Sir, I'm going to do so, and I'm going to do so gloriously, but I'm not quite there.
How are you going to get Blind Fury over to our boy, Fred Decker, in 6 degrees?
Do not doubt me. I will do it, and you will be awestruck. Before I do, there's one bit of trivia I want to divulge here, being the comic book geek that I am.
Okay.
There's another influence, aside from the Zatoichi films, that played into the writing of this film. And you may not have thought of it, but when I explain this, you're going to be like, So, Nick Parker, the main character, played by Rutger Hauer, and Frank Devereaux, who is Billy's father, who is the person Nick is wanting to mend, to forgive, right? They were both characters written as nods to Marvel Comics' Nick Fury and Frank Castle, who, you'll remember, Frank Castle was the Punisher.
I kind of wish I didn't know that.
As in both stories, both of these characters are war veterans.
Kind of wish you didn't
tell me. Whereas Nick Fury was blinded in one eye.
Oh my God.
And Frank Castle's wife also was killed by a criminal enterprise.
Oh, this writer. This writer wrote a film in your top 10 cult films of all time.
At no point did I say that the writer was the reason I picked it.
Oh, my.
Okay, 6 degrees or less, right?
6 degrees or less.
Would you believe I'm going to tell you I'm going to make this connection in the least number of degrees so far?
Okay, so we're either going to get Rutger Hauer, Terry O'Quinn.
It does not involve Shane Black.
Oh, I was going to say we were either going to get Rutger Hauer, Terry O'Quinn, or Meg Foster to Shane Black in 3 degrees or something.
And I was actually shooting for either Randall Tex Cobb or Meg Foster.
Okay. What'd you end up with?
Neither one of them.
What'd you end up with?
I'm going to throw you a curveball.
All right, let's do it.
Blind Fury stars Rutger Hauer, obviously. Rutger Hauer starred in Surviving the Game as the leader of the band of human hunters. Who was the victim in... Who was their prey in Surviving the Game?
I don't remember.
Ice-T. Remember, this was the less successful knockoff of Hard Target? Okay. Ice-T was the prey that Rutger Hauer's band of wealthy hunters were hunting. Ice-T also starred in Ricochet.
Okay.
Fred Decker is credited with writing the story for Ricochet.
Oh, look at you. Look at you. It all goes back to Fred
Doubt
Decker.
Doubt me not.
It all goes back to Fred Decker. These are easy because this is 70s and 80s and early 90s stuff, but... I mean,
but he's still... Fred Decker's still active, just not as a director.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm still batting a thousand, buddy. We'll see how long we can carry this out.
I had fun with this movie, but I was way... I'll be honest with you. I was way more interested in how you felt about this movie than how I felt about this movie. I was looking forward to this podcast.
That I pleased you or did I disappoint
so that you... No, absolutely. I wanted to see... I wanted all of your reasons why you liked this film, because when I was watching it, I was going, wow, this wouldn't be in my
top... So you were reacting to my wife having this, watched Out for Justice with me last time.
I was like, this wouldn't be in my top 10 anything. But...
Have your questions been answered, sir?
They have. Okay. And I had a lot of fun. Can't believe we got another hour and a half out of we once again went longer than the runtime.
Well, I imagine our next episode, sir, will go long.
I hope so.
Do you know what we're watching next episode?
One of my favorite films of all time. Willow.
Why don't you announce it? Yes,
Willow. Starring
directed by the one and only Opie.
Yeah. Ron Howard.
Yep.
And what is the little god damn it, he also His plays Leprechaun.
Is Warwick Davis.
Yes, Warwick Davis, who's the most, probably one of, is he the most famous? Well, no. Now Peter Dinklage is the most famous.
But Warwick Davis would be the most famous, but not necessarily recognizable. Peter Dinklage is definitely the most recognizably famous, little person, or whatever you prefer to be called now.
Also, one of the best roles of a pre-fat Val Kilmer.
Yes.
Very good role.
Which there's numerous of.
But we're not actually going to be reviewing Willow next week.
Right. You want to tell our listeners why.
Taking the week off. And actually, this podcast is going to air while I'm on the road to Horror on Weekend. So for the listening audience, they will still hear a podcast the week I'm out of town. But it's the following week that we won't have a podcast because I'm out of town. We record these podcasts on Sundays. And I'll still be in, just have come home to recuperate from Horror Hound Weekend in Cincinnati.
Is it Cincinnati this one?
Yeah, Horror Hound Cincinnati. And the big draw for this is John Waters, what's his name from the Saw series?
Toby something.
Yeah, Tobin Bell.
Yeah, Tobin Bell, yeah.
And
then they have a cast reunion for Monster Squad.
For Monster Squad, yeah. Except no Fred Decker this
and
time.
And one of your favorites.
Which was it?
Albert Pune.
Albert Pune is going to be debuting his new film, Interstellar Civil War, starring my friend Ellie Church. I'm super excited about seeing that film because this may well be Albert Pune's final film. He's got severe dementia, and he almost quit making movies. Ooh. He almost quit in the middle of this film because his dementia got so bad.
Yeah.
But he switched medicines and he was able to become lucid again. And he finished.
Not at all knocking someone for dementia. It's not my goal here at all. But we've experienced his films pre-dementia.
What I always like to say about Albert Pune. What I always like to say about Albert Pune is he might as well have had dementia when he was making. And that's no knock on him.
Wow. It's
nothing but respect. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. And we're going to get to either going to do Nemesis or Cyborg or one of his films.
Representing
one of my favorites, but his movies are so out there. So goofy that I can't wait to see one that he did at a later stage mentally to see, like, does he still have it? Right. Did he ever have it to begin with?
But for our listeners, if you're interested in knowing more, I believe, I haven't listened to it yet, but you have an episode on one of the other podcasts, kind of a preview.
Yeah, the last reading to strangers is called, like, Horror Hound Weekend Preview Show, and we didn't talk for a super long period of time about it, but we broke down who was all going to be there, and we talked again about Albert Pune, Interstellar Civil War, right. Ellie Church. Ellie Church's husband, Brian Williams, one of my good friends, his new film, also starring Ellie Church, Space Babes from Outer Space, is debuting. Getting to see that.
That just has USA Up All Night written all over it.
And made exactly like that. Goofy sex comedy film.
I'll never forget the title alone. Slimeball Babes.
Nah, something Babes from the Slime Ball Bowlerama.
Yeah, Slime Ball, yeah.
Something Babes.
Sorority Babes from the Slime Ball Bowlerama. There we go. Old Age is catching up with me. Yeah.
So, we're going to take a week off.
Yep.
But when we come back, we'll be doing Willow.
Yes.
And it will be glorious.
Yeah, it's been so long since I've seen it.
Oh, I can't wait. It's one of those movies I can watch anytime. There's a few of these that we, and that's why it's comprised of our top 10.
Right.
Movies I could watch.
Unlike Blind Fury.
Well, you know, maybe for you, you could watch that at any time.
I honestly could.
Not so much.
All right.
But I think you're a much bigger Jackie Chan kind of action comedy fan than I am. Not knocking your taste at all, you know what I mean? That's one of the things that makes this podcast cool is while we do have a ton of crossover that we're both into.
Next weekend is a great example.
We each have our specialties.
Right.
And see, the thing is, Willow, that's kind of my... I really like fantasy, 80s fantasy movies, so that's like in my wheelhouse.
Absolutely.
That's one of my favorite genres. One of my favorite genres of all time, 80s fantasy movies. So, like Dragon Slayer, Conan the Barbarian, Red Sonja, Willow, Legend.
I actually prefer Red Sonja to Conan, personally.
That's a great film. It always...
Don't leave out Beastmaster. Show some fucking Coscarelli love, man.
Beastmaster is fucking awesome. God, what a film.
Which, when we come back for our Patreon episode, encouraging you to become a Patreon member, Coscarelli's going to come up in what we talk about.
Okay, good. I have a lot to talk about this week.
This is going to be a long Patreon episode.
So, for everybody that doesn't know, doesn't have the gist, maybe this is the first time you listen, we always do an overrun episode each week where we talk about current films that Travis and I have been watching. Maybe we liked them, maybe we didn't. It's not our favorite films, it's just the films that we've been watching recently. Patreon only costs $1 to become a patron. It's $1 monthly pledge, and you can cancel at any time, but we have already, 9 or 10 weeks worth of episodes just for the overrun for Watching with Strangers. We also have our uncut, commercial-free, in their entirety, audiobooks that we do on the Reading to Strangers. Is a week, we do a weekly serial of my audiobooks of my fiction books, the fiction books that I write. And if you're a patron, you get those upfront, commercial-free. You can listen to the whole thing without having to listen to me and my co-host over there, Jeremy, babble on for 20 or 30 minutes before we get into that that stuff over there. So it's definitely worth, and you also get discounts on my books and whatnot. So definitely become a patron of The Strange. We would appreciate it. Your money goes towards making this podcast bigger and better, and will hopefully allow me and Travis to do bigger, cooler things like live shows and a bunch of different stuff with this particular podcast. So if you're not already a patron, please consider doing so at patreon.com/kevinthestrange. And that's it for me. Do you have anything else, Travis?
No, I'm good.
Alright, gang, keep
watching.
All music heard on the Watching with Strangers podcast, courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/.